This is the policy of each and every United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. True Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. The schedule for January, the Sunday morning meetings come under an umbrella topic, and it is the path of spiritual evolution. On next Sunday, the 25th, the title is Pitfalls on the Path of Progress. Our subject this morning is the critical pivotal point in evolution. On Wednesday evenings, our reference library opens at 5:15, closes at 7:15, and our study class in the Ocean of Theosophy goes from 7:30 to 8. Of course, all our meetings are free and all are welcome. The book table in the center hallway carries a line of straight line Theosophy literature that is sold at cost. If you do not and cannot purchase the books, you can go online, ask at the book table about the website that will allow you to peruse all of this material for free. What isn't free is taking care of this building so that it can be open for these meetings. So we are supported entirely by donations. We don't pass the hat. We don't charge fees or dues. So anything that you can give is gratefully accepted. Now, this morning, we will have a short talk on our subject and then ample time for questions and discussion.
The critical pivotal point in evolution. To begin this brief talk, let's take a look at the definition of evolution. We could speak of the evolution of the cosmos and its many infinite universes, or we could talk specifically about the evolution of our planet Earth from a gaseous globe eons of time ago to the blue sphere in space we know as our home today. or we could concentrate on the evolution of plants and animals. Or lastly, we could focus on the evolution of you and me. We believe that if we were to give the average person on the street a choice, they would probably lean towards talking about themselves, or in a much broader sense, the evolution of man. And we would certainly agree that man's emergence upon this visible and invisible world we call home is indeed the critical, pivotal point in evolution. So evolution, from the standpoint of man, could be the drive to betterment, the urge to superiority. If we look at it as the old materialists did, but if we look at it theosophically, according to the facts of nature, as we learn them, and according to the facts of our own instincts, from our very own being, then it means self-superiority, in the sense of rising on the ladder of life ever higher, with expanding vision, with expanding faculties and sympathies, not merely in the physical modalities of thinking, but growing greater from the spiritual core of our very being. In other words, it means opening up wider doors for that spiritual essence that is us, to pass its rays through and down into our personal minds, enlightening and leading us upwards and onwards. Man is his own history. He carries within him the entirety of an eons-long past. A cosmic entity, he enters Earth as a returning pilgrim in the process of becoming, of bringing into actuality that which is potential, hidden within his innermost essence, and which, given time and the appropriate environment, will flower into fullness. For evolution is no chance happening, but an orderly manifestation of the spiritual intelligent drive inherent in the universe, and therefore intrinsic in all life particles, not an atom, cell, human being, or sun could exist unless at the core of each were divinity. Theosophists look upon the evolution or the perfection of the physical body with profound interest, but with a far more profound and extensive searching of the heart does he study the evolution of the inner evolving man, which expresses itself through the physical vehicle, the body, and which on that account furnishes the drive, the urge, the impulse, ever upwards and forwards, causing that body to change its form slowly as the ages roll by, becoming with every new era, with every new vast period of time, a more fit vehicle to express the indwelling intellectual and spiritual forces and potencies of that inner hidden man. These spiritual forces or potencies seeking an outlet, seeking to express themselves, work through the infinitesimal particles of man's inner constitution. In the physical body, these are enshrined within the cells of that body, working through the atoms of which those cells are composed. Traditions all over the globe describe an event of titanic, critical importance, which occurred millions and millions of years ago, the quickening of mind in man, the lighting up of manas, of mind in childlike humanity. where before what we can only call the human form had a consciousness that had been dreamlike. But with the incarnation of a thinker, it was now afire. With the vigor of self-consciousness, thought of choice, and the will to evolve. Legend and myth, scripture and temple, preserve the record of this wondrous transition from mindlessness to self-awareness, to knowledge and responsibility, all due to the incarnation of ourselves, spiritual beings, perceivers who lit up the lower form, and thus who wrought within it a living mind, a new mastery of thought. And from this point forward, the evolution of man, the human kingdom's advancement has been driven by self-induced and self-devised ways, of course, totally checked by karma. Thus it is that the evolutionary drive finds its outlet. It comes from within, expresses itself through the transitional nature of man, then finds an expression through the physical vehicle in order that self-consciousness, free thinking, and discerning entity may see the world of matter even as we do, and draw such lessons from companionship with it, as a master, not as a slave. There is an overwhelming and irresistible amount of evidence confirming that consciousness is one, and that while it manifests in different ways, in stone, in plant, animal, and human, it is one elegant river of life. Experiments with plants, for example, suggest plant sensitivity to human thoughts, to music. If there is reciprocity of vibration, both positive and negative, between plants and humans, it surely exists among other species. The continuous interchange of thought energies, of thought atoms, among us is not limited to the human kingdom, or for that matter, to our planet. When we reflect on the living network of magnetic and soul force between ourselves and every other aspect of the cosmic organism we call our universe, we sense something of the magnitude of our responsibilities. If we could view all that occurs in our personal circumstances, in our social and communal relationships from this perspective, from the eye of our immortal self, we would transform every aspect of human living. Let us never forget then that the universe is one vast living organism. There are no impassable barriers between body and body, between mind and mind, between entity and entity, all of them being children or offspring, coherent parts of the vast organism of the cosmos, and in consequence having and manifesting in the small all the potencies, powers, energies, and forces that exist in the never-ending organic universe. The offspring is a replica, a copy in the minute of the great, the microcosm or little world copying in all respects the macrocosm or great world. This sublime fact of nature, that all beings are inextricably linked together on all the various planes from the spiritual to the physical, theosophy expresses by the term universal brotherhood. We might even call it the spiritual or divine oneness of all that is. Once a man recognizes the working of the law upon the human plane, he knows that every step forward that a brother takes is an advancement for himself. And furthermore, He knows that by as much as any spiritual unit, any soul progresses, by that amount does it also raise the entire body of beings to which it belongs. In closing, from a book of quotations by Robert Crosby, man occupies the most important place in the world whole scheme of evolution. He stands where spirit and matter meet. He is the link between the higher beings and those below. He has so to act, so to think, and act in and upon and with this physical matter that he raises it all up and gives it another tendency, another trend. Once again, the topic for today, the critical pivotal point in evolution.
We'd like to ask you a question. That quote that we just heard, man, occupies. Would you read that again?
Man occupies the most important place in the whole scheme of evolution. He stands where spirit and matter meet.
That's it. He stands where spirit and matter meet. What does that mean to you, and why is that the pivotal point? Yes?
I think it's related to the question I was going to ask, and that single word, incarnation.
Yes.
Are there other words we can use?
Well, we'll come back to your question. You remind us if we don't. Why is where spirit and matter meet in man the pivotal point? Yes.
Because at that point, man is self-conscious. The spirit of matter is also in the lower kingdoms, but not self-conscious, conscious on that plane.
Yes, that is certainly a big part of it. Yes.
It's where spirit can elevate matter.
Because? Yes.
Well, spirit needs matter to express itself.
And
we have this form to express our consciousness.
Yes, imagine being a great musician and there's no such thing as an instrument. Being a great artist and there's no canvas or paper. How can you express and therefore improve by that expression? But there is a pivotal point here. What happens when spirit and matter meet? Yes, self-consciousness meets consciousness. It now has a piano, a saxophone, a canvas, paper. But what it brought with it as a pivot is choice. Only we as thinkers can look in both directions. This is what I did. This is what I want to do. This is what I know is selfish. This is what I know is lofty. I then, having that contrast, can make a choice. We're the only choosers in that sense. Everything else is acting from a noble or higher impression. In the lower kingdoms, it's limited. In the higher kingdoms, it's limited. They must stay within the laws and principles of the universe. The only chooser is man, the thinker in incarnation. And it's how we have created all the trouble we have in our own lives and in the lives of the world around us. But without that pivot, there would be no growth. If you couldn't see what you did wrong, how could you possibly learn to do better? Well, we see we have silenced everybody. We're very sorry. That was such a good talk. There should be... Oh, yes, back to yours. Is there another word? What do you think? The incarnation of the thinker is said to have taken place 18 million years ago. Now, that means we have been in incarnation for a very long time on this planet. Is there another word for incarnation? Yes? Well, it's funny, huh?
Accumulation?
Yes, yes, that's very true. Accumulation of impression. And here's where we run into that very fine line. This is why we can never judge anybody, including ourselves, because what we see is a temporary expression of what we've accumulated, because something needs to be worked out. But behind and beyond that is all the knowledge we have gained, all the wisdom. And perhaps, as Mr. Judge says in chapter 2 of the Gita Notes, initiations that we have actually experienced that are, what's the word, kept from us now. Because if we knew them, we wouldn't be working on the problem we have. We would just assume we're too wise to have to deal with that. So we have to clean up as we go along. Yes?
Lord, if that makes sense, because you can just do so much. It's like if you have a pitcher and you fill it up with water. Well, there's just so much water that's going to fit in that one pitcher till someone starts...
Exactly. If you pour it out, if you figure that out, whatever that is, you're then open and ready for more. And that's, we think, often what is shocking to a student of this, because the greater the effort you make to fix things in yourself and to behave as you see one should, the more difficulties are going to come to you, because you are fixing things, therefore you're ripe and ready to fix the next thing. So instead of being defeated or discouraged, we should go, well, I must be doing okay if, you know, in this course, if I'm now taking the next test up. Yes?
There's also a tendency in people to, anything they do well, that's what they want to do.
Yes, well, of course. Why not?
You don't want to do the things that, you know, I'm a great singer, I don't need to be a great human being.
Well, that usually is the problem with genius, and that's what happens, is there's a single focus, and everything moves that way. And people are not surprised that someone who's a genius is also a mean, miserable, selfish, inconsiderate human being, because all their focus is on themselves and their specialty. What do we suppose karma does then to someone in that condition? Yes?
When you say that karma does, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that does sound like somebody out there going zap, doesn't it? What results as the karma or the effect from setting up the kind of cause of a particular thing that prevents you from caring about anybody else? Yes?
Well, so in one life, if a person has certain great capacities but is really lacking in other capacities in terms of
human
relationships,
yeah.
So he's lacking in the use of his own soul power of compassion, that's most important. So karma will mercifully in his next life create opportunities for him where compassion is going to have to grow, and probably that might mean cutting off some of the stuff that distracted him from it.
Yes. Yeah, and twofold. Cutting off, in other words, you have this genius capacity, but it is forbidden to you for the moment because you need to learn the other. And you learn the other usually by suffering. You have to wish for compassion for yourself before you will ever see that it's necessary to anybody else. So you read about geniuses and things, and you might be jealous of them, but if you read about their personal characteristics and they're very low, then you should feel sorry for them. Because we imagine it's a terrible, terrible crash for the soul to go from that capacity to a completely altered life. But going back to the word, incarnation means in the flesh, carne. So is there any other word we could use for ourselves? Yes.
Well, word embodiment.
Yes.
Is one.
Yes.
And in connection with that, what came to mind, the words that we use all the time, industrial manufacturing.
I don't understand what you mean.
What?
This is not an industry. If it were, I'd be bankrupt.
Well, if you think of the assembly line, it could reach from Walnut Street all the way up into the Northeast. And every block is a part of the whole finished product. The next street.
Okay, we understand what you're saying. We have to disagree with you. We are not a finished product. And there we come back to the pivot again. We, as we find ourselves right now, no matter how poor in any quality, we are identical to the Buddha. We are identical to Christ, to Krishna, to any wise being that you can picture, because we have everything identically in potential. Our pivot, however, is around a different desire. Their pivot was to serve humanity, to serve life. Our pivot is to serve ourselves, or to get this particular part that will make us more appealing, attractive, wonderful. We're focused on ourselves. They're focused on service. So we have to change our pivot, and then we'll realize that all the parts are available to us. Yes.
And so that it's not so overwhelming when these ideas finally start to sink in, and you go, oh my gosh, what are we, a product in processing, in motion. There's an expression that they use in today's, we're a product in promotion or something.
Well, we're an ongoing process of learning, but you know, it's like in the ocean when Mr. Judge talks about someone like de Lesseps, who was a very, very famous Frenchman, who was involved in some very, very extremely complicated successful ventures. And then he ended up with the Panama Canal. And there were failures, and none of them were his fault. But he was pulled down because of that. And it's some old karma coming to him. And it had nothing to do with his activities or behavior in that life. So instead of being discouraged, we have to realize whatever is going on, it's some debt that's unrecognized by us. And then we're free of it if our attitude is right. If we cling to it and, you know, it's, this isn't fair, I don't like this, I don't want this, then we haven't paid the debt completely. Yes.
I worked with a woman years ago who lived in a trailer, had three or four children, no husband, and I kid you not, every single day came in with a story of the woe of her life.
Mm-hmm.
But she spoke it and spoke about it with a sense, but this is something I can handle. And I was always amazed. I would say, oh, no, I'm so sorry. She'd say, no, I'll get through this. And it's what you were talking about. If we are dealing with this old karma and it's coming, you know, the picture keeps filling up. It's also partly the attitude and motive of our hearts as we work through this. And I imagine she'll have a lifetime where the opposite will be.
Well, it isn't, let's put it the other way. The most important thing is our reaction to anything. It's not the event, It's how we label it, how we feel about it, how we deal with it. Our attitude represents the position that we take as a spiritual being. And if you put it in the mundane world, it's much easier to deal with. If I have run around and charged things at every store in Center City, and I don't have any money, I don't intend to pay for any of it, and I suddenly find myself in big trouble for that, if I think, well, they were mean to do this to me, or this is wrong, it's not fair, then I have doubled the debt. If I instead say, I was wrong, what I did was wrong, and I have to pay off this debt as long as it takes. It's a completely different karma. In other words, we will work through it and come out more knowledgeable, stronger, and we'll probably never go into debt again because we have learned how painful it is. If we do the other, then we will face that karma again and again until we stop complaining about it. It's our powers that have brought us everything we have, not just the negative, the good as well. Yes?
I may digress a little bit. When you earlier said we are all, we are the Buddha, we are the Christ, and believe that.
We are identical to
it. We are identical.
Yes.
I want to add another phrase to that, which is also a common phrase, that we are gods in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And we as individuals are the ones who make.
Yes.
Who do the things, deal with our karma, to deal with things, to complete our
development.
Our development,
mm-hmm,
as to become
gods.
True gods.
Yes,
complete.
Yes. But if we didn't.
Or a portion of what is God.
It's so hard to talk about.
I know, it's very hard.
It is. It is. But it's only because we are that that we can actually say we can become that. In other words, we are the seed of divinity. And most of the religions and the consciousness of religious people, they are waiting for something to be given to them or done to them. They have to be saved. They have to be blessed. They need this grace or that grace. And Theosophy says, wait. There is nothing you need but that pivot. Learn to make the right choices to use your spiritual powers in a positive way instead of the selfish way you have been, and then you are beginning to express your God-like nature. Yes?
And there will be many people, like what you are saying, if you say to them, we are gods, they will say, this is a travesty.
Oh, of course. They're offended.
You are, can't think of the word, but I mean, it's just preposterous.
Blasphemous.
How can you say that?
Blasphemous, yes. You know, there was a wonderful letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to his nephew, and it was evidently the nephew was talking about God and his feelings, and he said, don't even believe in God. Believe in goodness and try to express that yourself, because that is God-like, and that's more important than believing in some being outside of you. Yes.
Oh. Up because
oh.
It's the God up there.
But it isn't the God up there, is it? Where is the God that we seek? Yeah, everybody is pointing to the right place. We have to learn to think with the heart and to feel with the brain. We have to recognize that unity. One of the Mahatmas wrote about humanity, how funny that we have these lofty ideas and then we think nothing of killing a mosquito. And yet it's all one and the same life. And it's our attitude about it we have to develop and work on. Yes? Yes.
But the word embodiment.
Wait, I didn't hear what the word.
The word embodiment.
Okay.
That is the thing that we have to keep in mind. Embodied consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of the word spirit. We are spiritual beings. The two words actually are companions, but one is superior to the other. Spirit using matter.
Okay, can we come back in a second?
Yes.
Because we would like to challenge what you just said. You said one is superior to the other. And if you can show me where in theosophy that is said, I will agree with you. But I disagree completely. We are told that matter is spirit. That spirit and matter are two sides of the same coin or the front and back of a hand. If matter is spirit, how can spirit be superior to it? It can't be. And as a matter of fact, if you stop and think about it, if we were going to say, well, I'm going to pray to something, we should be sending gratitude to matter all the time. Why? Because it took a lesser position. It is in the position of being used, of being of service, of being impressed. We should be grateful for that. It is the same as the highest thing we can imagine, and it's taken the lowest position. We walk on spirit. We call it earth. Amazing. We swim in spirit. We call it air. All of these forces and principles are just as much expression of spirit as is our individuality. So we don't think you can say it's superior. Yes.
We would agree. 100%.
Oh, good.
And that is the problem.
Yeah.
We create for ourselves. We think and act from a materialistic point of view when universal brotherhood is in fact in nature. So we are spirit using matter.
Which is spirit.
Which is spirit. And so therefore simplicity in the statement would be that, what is the terminology for that? Simplicity, that's the key. We are divine beings.
Right.
Using that aspect of nature here called materiality.
And we think it's for our own pleasure and satisfaction. But that's because we have lost the real truth of why we're here. And we think, well, all I have is this one life. And if I don't look out for me, you're not going to. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And I better get out there and get what I can get. And as long as we think that way, our religions are materialized. We sincerely believe that we will end up in a heaven state in this body. We don't know if you've ever read Mark Twain's last book, which he would not let be published until after he died. It was called Letters from the Earth. And it was this god who had come to visit this strange planet, writing back, "You would not believe what these people believe." And he, one of the things he wrote was, "The Christian idea of heaven sure sounds like hell to me. You're hanging around with all these people you couldn't get along with on earth, and they can't sing, and you can't sing, and you're all singing." I mean, it's just, the book is a riot, but it's also a very heartfelt reality of how foolish the ideas we hold are, because we were given to them by people we love and cherish, our parents, and by ministers and rabbis that we love and trust. And we have these infantile ideas. So as long as we are in that condition, we are going to be materialized. It's very funny that the Christians believe in heaven, but show me how many Christians are eager to die. They're afraid of death. They're more afraid of death than maybe most people, which doesn't make any sense based on what they accept. So we have to look at our ideas, discover which of them are valid, are provable through our own life, and then we turn to studying the higher ideas. Yes?
We think it makes perfect sense that they don't want to die.
Yeah.
They're told that they're poor, miserable sinners, that they're imperfect, that they're not perfectible. So what are the odds that you're going to go to heaven?
Yeah, that's true. And we never thought about it that way. Thank you. Yeah, they kind of had the odds stacked against them. Yes.
Well, part of the answer is they're also told if they're saved and forgiven on the deathbed, there's a ritual that I guess the object of is to allow them into heaven. So they can also lead a life of any kind
yes.
and still be saved.
That's the HPB's great point of where is the justice in, and I think she uses an example of a murderer, someone who murdered an innocent person. And the innocent person, boom, is dead instantly, has no chance to ask for forgiveness from anybody, and yet the criminal on his deathbed can have the chance to ask for forgiveness and be forgiven. So you have the one in heaven and the other is debatable. Where is the justice in that? As a matter of fact, I think HPB's questions, if you really take them to heart, make you really look at everything you ever thought you knew. Her thing about where is heaven for the young mother who has just died, who is looking down and seeing her children turn to another woman as mother, see her husband turn to another woman as wife. How is that heaven for her? Think of the suffering of that. So we have this twisted reality about the states after death, which colors and affects how we live and think and feel here. Again, it's that the pivot is choice, but the pivot is on ideas, on how we think. If I choose selfishly, it's perfectly reasonable if I believe that's all there is to life, what I get for myself. If I instead, I choose to be unselfish, realizing the unity of life, I begin to change where I am inside my own head and heart. Remember, it says in the Gita that, you know, we really don't even need all these spiritual books because they're already in us. We just don't have access at the moment.
There's been a lot of coverage in the last few days about Pope Francis in the Philippines, and a 12-year-old asked him about the conditions that children are being sold into slavery and just the horrible grinding poverty, and what do you have to say about that? He didn't have an answer. He just said it makes you cry. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't, you know, so karma and reincarnation is the missing chord, the missing
right.
key that makes sense of things. It's just, you know, and he's not, he may even believe in himself.
I think absolutely he does.
And he can't put it out there yet, at least. He might, but.
We knew a rabbi at the University of Pennsylvania, and we used to go out to lunch once a month, and we would talk about theosophy. I mean, that's all he wanted to know about. And after about a year, he said he was leaving. He was no longer going to be a rabbi. I'm like, but why? You're a wonderful teacher, and you're increasing your ideas. And he said, because I can't stand up in front of people and pretend this limitation of God. I can't do it. And he went on to be an administrator in the Jewish whatever league thing. But people in a very lofty position who have ideas that are in contrast to that position are in an awful place. We would imagine that before he dies, he will say something, and he will point to the history back to, you know, the year 500 and say how this was deceitfully altered. that's coming up in our ocean class. So the fact is, though, that if someone really begins to think and look, they can't help but realize there is more to life than just this one life. We like what Voltaire said. It is no more shocking to be born again than to have been born in the first place. Very logical. Yes?
We had a friend years ago that was at St. Charles Seminary with the intention, full intention, of becoming a priest. And a couple of years after he started, I saw him, and he was waiting tables or something. And I said, what happened? He said, we are taught there about all the world's religions. And when I realized everything there is and what it means and how important it is, the seeds and all these little phrases and sayings, I could no longer say this was it. I couldn't do it. And I, as was said, I bet it happens a lot if they're sincere and looking and understanding.
And I think it's a karmic blessing from efforts in the past. And they have reached that point where they can no longer stand on that false position. You had your hand up several times. No, the lady. Yeah.
You earlier made a sort of passing comment that, we aren't concerned about killing a mosquito.
We're not. Oh, the mosquito, right?
Or someone isn't. And it raised this thing in me that all of nature that is not man is a unity. There is a symbiosis. Mm-hmm. Everything works together. Yes, I mean the animals eat each other, and you know all that. But there is a harmony in nature. But man is not part of that harmony because we have the free will. And we can make choices. And through making the choices, we have to come back to be conscious.
Yes, the realization.
In this harmony. And that is that long millions of years process that we go through.
But it is happening now more
and
more.
The suffering.
Yeah.
But
we think when the master wrote about that, he meant you're outside in their world and you think nothing of killing a mosquito. We reached a crisis within our own home where we had cockroaches and we didn't know what to do. We didn't want to kill them. And we asked an older student and they said, no, if it's on in your property and things, you can take the necessary steps. It's just that you would not go out into their world and kill them or prevent them. So it's a question of balance. It's how we treat each other, how we treat life, and it's a realization and a growth process. We have to unlearn all the things we think are absolute facts. Yes?
I agree. The thing about the harmony and stuff
of nature. We'll come back. It hurts the brain to struggle like that.
I'm sorry, but it just popped out of my mind.
Okay. Yes.
Well, anyone who has been in an area that's infected with malaria, they're going to smack that mosquito.
Right. But, you know, it kind of circles itself, doesn't it? Is that area that way because of that behavior in the past? I mean, to study and think about karma is just a fascinating thing. There are, of course, now more than there were, 100 years ago, methods for treating and for helping. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of course, when it comes to pests, and more, certainly we also have the duty to create the conditions in our world that would not invite those pests.
Yes.
To keep the screen closed or living in the city of Philadelphia, not only to keep the doors to your car locked, but also don't let there be anything seen that might be valuable in there.
Yes.
And you're doing both him and yourself a favor.
Exactly.
It's your duty to do that.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's one of the things we think people don't often think of, that if you provide the temptation to someone who might do a criminal thing, karmically you're involved in that. It's our duty to be responsible citizens. Yes?
Then the opposite of that is if somebody offers to do something for you and you say no, it's almost like you're depriving the person who wants to do it for you a chance to do something.
That's absolutely true. We should never interfere with someone else's opportunity to be kind or generous. Equally with ourselves. I think Mr. Judge says if you feel an urge to do something that's kind or good, do it. Act on it. Don't make it just a feeling, because you will start losing the energy to behave that way. Yes, you remembered.
Yes, I remember. Everything that you're saying fits together. But what we are doing now,
mm-hmm.
is we are corrupting natural processes. And
that's not new.
Well, no, it's not new, but it's getting more and more. Nature is being destroyed.
But how does change happen? For most of us, we have to crash. We have to get the very worst results, and then we'll say, what am I doing wrong, or how do I fix this? So the conditions that we have created, we can't turn them around overnight. It's going to take a long time. Yes?
The formula for that is dissatisfaction brings change.
Yes. And change can be very, very slow. Why don't people like change? Because they have no hope or plan for the future. And we think that's the most beautiful thing that theosophy gives you. No matter how ugly, depressing, unhappy everything seems at the moment, the soul is learning from it, and the conditions will change when the lesson is learned. Yes.
I can rarely get my brother to be quiet, but one time I did. We were talking about he was talking about the world.
I bet he says the same thing about you, but go on.
No, he's the big brother. And the conditions and everything, but I won't be here much longer, so it doesn't matter.
Ah.
And I says, you have grandchildren.
Right.
Don't you care about them? And I didn't even, he knows I believe in reincarnation.
Right.
But
this was the practical answer.
Yes.
Yeah. And it silenced him, huh?
Yes.
I bet it may even have altered some of his behavior.
Awesome.
We do act that way. Here is some particular thing that drives me crazy. When you live in a big old building, it takes a long time for the hot water to get to the pipes. Let's say you want to take a shower. You have to turn the hot water on, and it's cold, and it's cold, and it's cold, and it's a little warm, and it's a little warm. And you feel like 50 gallons have gone by. It hasn't, but that's how it feels. How wrong is that? There are people all over the world who have no fresh water, and you're throwing away all these gallons of fresh water. Why hasn't somebody invented something so that all this water is collected, or so that you had dirty water in your house so you could use it for stupid chores? Like, your plants wouldn't care if it was dirty water. I mean, it's like, if we didn't have water, we would care passionately about these things. We would be so creative and brilliant. But because we have in a great abundant amount, we don't pay any attention. It's the same as what your brother thought. What do I care? I've got it. I can do what I want with it. Yes.
Yes, but we're getting ready to see karma work its magic as far as that abundance of water is concerned.
Yep.
It's a worldwide problem, and now it's being addressed as probably the next big problem in our existence. So.
Right, right. And there's states in the United States that are suffering horribly right now, and a lot of it is from bad management. I mean, we recall when Arizona was the place to go if you had asthma, and it was because there was nothing growing there that was polleny or grassy or any of those things. And so all these people moved to Arizona, and the first thing they did was put in a lawn. And then the next thing they had to do was bring the water. So it's created a lack, and it was stupid to begin with. You should take and respect the circumstances where you live. Yes?
Two quick things. Not only that, but in Arizona now, as you enter a store, a fog of nice cool mist comes over you.
Oh, how awful.
They have created humidity where there was
well,
seriously, in this big mall across from where the convention was, I kept saying, where is this coming from? Every single store. But we were thinking, a while ago you were talking about the circumstances we get may make us want to stop trying. We had a funny experience a couple of days ago. Walking down Broad Street, a woman asked me for help. She said, can you help me get a hamburger or some food? And I was heading to the post office, so I needed the cash I had. I said, whatever's in my pocket is yours. Well, it was only a quarter, but it was a quarter, and I handed it to her. She looked so stricken and handed it back to me and walked away. And I thought, okay, this didn't work, but it won't stop me from trying in the future.
But actually it had nothing to do with you, but had to do with her expectations and disappointments. We just wanted to close with a couple of things. We think this is absolutely charming. It's from a Chinese proverb. The person who says it cannot be done should not interrupt the person doing it. And we wanted to end with a quote from HPB. And this is particularly mentioned at this time of year, but we should think about this every single day. Every person who draws the breath of life affects the mental and moral atmosphere of the world and helps to color the day for those about him. Those who do not help to elevate the thoughts and lives of others must, of necessity, either paralyze them by indifference or actively drag them down. We color the world by how we think, by how we feel. We are so important, but we have to be humble about it at the same time, because so is everyone else. A meeting is adjourned.